Hello and welcome back to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. I'm John Hare, substituting for our host Charles Showalter this week. Today we're interviewing Peter Gilmore about a very interesting, provocative, controversial individual. His name is Andrew Carnegie. Peter is a perfect person to talk about this because Peter has a history that I think qualifies him to understand what's going on with Andrew Carnegie. Peter was for 30 years a labor activist with the United Electrical Workers. Eventually ended up editing their newspaper, right, Peter?
That's right.
And now that he's in his active years of retirement, he's teaching history, making use of that degree, right?
That's right.
At Carlo University, he's an adjunct professor, and his recent course was Understanding Andrew Carnegie. Peter, did I get your history right? Is there anything you want to add to that?
That's just fine.
Good. Why should working people around the country, not just in the Pittsburgh area, but around the country, have an interest in Andrew Carnegie? What's the importance of that?
Andrew Carnegie did a great deal to organize and to influence what becomes the American Industrial Revolution. The industrial supremacy of the United States in iron and steel in particular, but also coal and oil, owes something to Carnegie's genius of being the right person in the right place at the right time. So that's part of it. It's difficult to imagine the Industrial Revolution, particularly in Western Pennsylvania, but also the rest of the United States, without this little Scottish immigrant. But at the same time, Carnegie set his brand on how companies, big companies, would relate to employees. And Carnegie's message was, the owners know best, and the intelligent working person respects and obeys. And it makes it even more interesting because Carnegie thought of himself as a working man and craved the respect and admiration of labor leaders. So he thought he was doing the right thing for working people by taking the positions he did. But the bottom line was, respect my bottom line.
So I guess we call this, how do our bosses get the way they are too, huh?
Well, it's a part of it. How does our labor movement end up the way it is? How did it develop? Carnegie successfully eliminated unions in the key U.S. manufacturing industry of a century ago, steel. Everything ran on steel. The buildings were created out of steel. America's military might was built on steel. Carnegie organized the companies that produced the steel, and he created these companies non-union. And there's an important lesson in that.
There certainly is. Well, let's go back to the beginning and tell us a little bit about where Andrew Carnegie came from. We're talking 18th century.
19th century. He was born in 1835 in the town of Dunfermline in Scotland. He was born in very modest circumstances. How modest? His father was a handloom weaver and owned or rented a two-story, two-room house. Think about that, two stories, two rooms. The bottom floor was mostly filled with his father's loom, and the family lived in the one room on the top floor. That's where Carnegie was born in 1835. And Carnegie learned at a relatively young age about technological change, because in his childhood, the kind of work his father did was eliminated by progress. And the family, being very poor, decided they had little or no choice but to leave. Actually, his mother pushed the father into moving to the Pittsburgh area where her twin sisters had relocated.
So here they come across the ocean, settle in Pittsburgh in
1848. 48. Actually, It's now Pittsburgh's North Shore. It was then the city of Allegheny. If you've seen the pictures of Heinz Field and PNC Park, that's where that's about where the Carnegies lived when that was a slum area. Mm-hmm. They lived in a house on an alley behind the house Carnegie's aunt had bought and lived in. This is an area that was prone to flooding. This is at a time when Allegheny City's prime industry was tanneries. So the waters, the streets, the atmosphere were filled with rotting animal carcasses and the stink of the bark left over from tanning.
I can smell it now. Hey, how old was Carnegie at the time, and how did he get started? What happened then?
He was 12 years old, and his first job was working as a bobbin boy in one of Allegheny City's other big industries, cotton textile manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And there's a little story behind that. The Pennsylvania legislature had bowed to the demands of labor, if you can imagine that, and passed a law that allowed for a 10-hour day. Understand that most textile workers were working 11, 12 hours a day. So this was a big improvement, but there was also not surprising for the Pennsylvania legislature. They wrote in a provision that allowed employers to insist that employees sign an individual contract waiving their rights.
Uh-huh. Yellow dog contract?
Yeah, yellow dog contract. And also, when the law went into effect, docked workers' pay according to the number of hours that they worked. And so there was a strike. There was a terrifically violent strike where the textile workers, mostly women and people in the community, took axes and broke down the doors of the mills and dragged out the scabs. And in that atmosphere, the employers needed extra hands. This is after the strike had been settled unfavorably for the workers. And Carnegie and his father apparently signed these yellow dog contracts to go to work in the mill. Carnegie was 12 years old. Neither he or his father lasted long there. Eventually, while still just about 13, Carnegie got his first big break. Because his uncle knew a guy who knew a guy, he got a job working as a messenger for a telegraph company. This is still 1848. It's only 4 years after the first message sent by telegraph. So this is still, believe it or not, a cutting-edge technology. Mm-hmm. Carnegie's job was to take the message transcribed from the Morse code and go running around Pittsburgh. Well, Pittsburgh at the time consisted of a very small area. Find the street, find the guy to whom the message was addressed. And that's what he did. Although he had a sharp mind and an incredibly retentive memory. Mm-hmm. So he learned how to operate the telegraph himself and advanced to being a telegraph operator, which put him in line for his next big break, which was to go to work for the brand new Pennsylvania Railroad, which had just opened a line to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. The head of the Western Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad wanted somebody to work with him who could be a telegraph operator, and he picked Carnegie. And that was Carnegie's first really big break, because then he benefited from all kinds of insider information which allowed him to make his first stock investments while, you know, not out of his teens.
Wow. So we're talking about a young Scottish immigrant who now is working his way up in a very fluid situation of change in our country. What happened next? And we have maybe about a minute before we need to take a break, because we're talking about a guy that by the age of 25, his individual circumstances had changed considerably, right?
Oh, they had. Carnegie, because of his close working relationship with Tom Scott of the Pennsylvania Railroad, got insider information, made investments which proved profitable. He invested heavily in another new industry, oil, which had been discovered in western Pennsylvania, made a ton of money in oil, and launched and organized various businesses for the manufacture of iron bridges, iron rails, iron for locomotives. And so while he's still in his 20s, he's working his way up the ladder. But let's not forget that had he not known people, had he been from Poland or Italy, had he been Catholic or Jewish, had he been an African American, he never would have had these jobs and would never have started up the ladder to success.
We're talking about a real American story, one that is subject to lots of interpretation, the story of Andrew Carnegie. And we're pleased today to be talking to Peter Gilmore. What happens then?
In his early 20s, he's named the superintendent of the Western Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad.
Holy smokes.
And it's a different era, and he was doing things that might be illegal today. He's creating companies that produce bridges and rails and locomotives out of iron while he's still an employee of the Pennsylvania Railroad, and his customers are, guess what, the Pennsylvania Railroad. So, and his major investors are the president and vice president of the railroad. So they're all benefiting, you know, at every end of the transactions. Both Carnegie and his bosses are making money hand over fist because of the work that Carnegie's companies are doing for the railroad. In 1865, while he's, you know, barely 30, he, not quite 30, he retires, or leaves, I should say, the railroad company to concentrate on his own businesses. And while he's doing that, he's also taking on a new career as a bond salesman. So he makes lots of money doing that as well. And this is all before he becomes the steel baron that he's best known for. He and his partners, including his younger brother Tom, built the Lucy Furnace in 1870, which at the time had the largest capacity of any furnace in the United States for producing iron. So that's a big part of Pittsburgh's iron boom. Pittsburgh had already had rolling mills, already had furnaces. Pittsburgh was already producing iron. But the U.S. economy was kick-started, if you can believe this, by the terrible slaughter and the economic demands of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So the real Industrial Revolution in the United States occurs after the Civil War, and Carnegie, as always, is the right person at the right place at the right time, is able to benefit from that by building this furnace, and then a few years after that, adopts the still cutting-edge revolutionary technology of the Bessemer process for making steel. So builds the first Bessemer process plant in western Pennsylvania.
Which presumably are much more productive and have much greater capacity.
Much more productive, and also eliminates the role of the skilled worker.
Uh-huh.
So the more the product is automated, the less the knowledge and the skill of the individual worker has an influence over the way the production process is organized.
So Carnegie is both the builder and the owner of this?
Yeah. He's the prime mover. He's the prime stockholder. At age 36, 35, I think, he had already made his first million and decided that he wasn't going to work a full year ever again, and he didn't. But he was able to do that by never working for anybody else. He owned his own companies. And as far as he was concerned, that was the way to do it. You don't want to be at the beck and call of a board of directors. Who cares what those other people think? You know, if you're the primary owner, you can do what you want. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm. So we have now Carnegie, the steel entrepreneur, and presumably that grows into a larger empire.
It does. So he stays aware of the changes in technology. And he does something that unfortunately we don't see enough of in manufacturing or other businesses today, and that's putting the profits back into the company. You know, don't get me wrong, he liked the big fat dividend as the chief stockholder, but he also preferred to put profits back into the process. So, you know, unlike what happened in Pittsburgh in the 1980s, the plants weren't starved of investment money.
And renovation and improvement, technological improvement. And
continual improvement. But along with that improvement and insistence on driving his employees as hard as possible to get what he wanted. Understand that Carnegie had a very peculiar philosophy. You know, he's benefiting himself, no doubt about it, and he enjoys being a very, 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 very wealthy man. But he bought heavily into the philosophy of Herbert Spencer. This was the English philosopher who, building on the scientific work of Charles Darwin, developed a theory about the evolution of human society. Carnegie convinced himself that this was an unchangeable law, that society was going to develop, and the development of society required the enrichment of individuals like him, who would then be responsible for plowing the wealth back into the community. Okay, that sounds good, except he was convinced that people like him knew better than families as to how to spend the wealth those families were creating. So nobody could get or should get in his way.
In his way.
Because he was working, he was an agent for the good of all. And of course, the good of Andrew Carnegie.
Of course. So Carnegie makes an alliance with Frick, or hires Frick more properly, and the steel industry booms, fueled by the Civil War and post-war construction.
The interesting connection with Frick is interesting because it's so fraught. I mean, you know, Carnegie wanted to be loved and admired because he thought he was so smart. And he wanted Frick to look upon him as, you know, this great business leader, this mentor, someone who he could learn from. Frick thought the old guy was irritating. But the way they came together is that Frick, by means often quite ruthless, had become the principal owner of coal mines and coking works in southwestern Pennsylvania. Coke, you know, coke is to coal as charcoal is to wood. And it was a necessary ingredient in steel making. Carnegie wanted the best coke, and he wanted a good steady supply of coke. So he reached an agreement with Frick, which gave Carnegie controlling interest in Frick's company. But then he gave Frick an interest in Carnegie Brothers Steel.
But not controlling.
No, oh no, 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 no. Carnegie would never relinquish control willingly. I mean, eventually he did in 1901 when he finally sold out, but on his own terms, and made him the richest man in the world.
So we have about a minute to compress a lot of history here. The aftermath of the Homestead Steel Strike, 1892, was a defeat of the Union. Carnegie is gallivanting around Europe while Frick is administering the iron fist to the Union. How do we understand this young Scotsman who has a kind of a radical history in Scottish Chartism, right?
That's right.
How do we understand him today? He gave a lot of charitable donations for libraries around the country, but it came on the back of a lot of blood and sweat of the U.S. workers.
He squeezed the life out of people to become very wealthy thinking that it was his job to give the wealth back. And nobody could do it as well as he could. And to do that, he repeatedly broke unions. Homestead's the biggest example. He very gladly let Frick bear the blame for that. But the ultimate decision was Carnegie's, and Carnegie's decision had been that the union had to go.
So for those of us living in the aftermath, we're trying to build a different kind of decision-making process about what should happen to the surpluses of our labor, right? It's fun to read about Carnegie, but that power should probably never be invested in one or two people, and it needs to be subject to decisions in the interest of the community.
It should be decided upon on a democratic basis. And in his head, I think Carnegie, or his heart maybe, Carnegie believed that. But he had convinced himself or deluded himself into thinking that it had to be the decision of one person. But yes, it's a decision of the community. And had the community made the decisions about where Carnegie's wealth went, the results would have been very different.
Peter, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it, and a fascinating story and a lot more to tell. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. Tune in to us on your computer at theunionedge.com.